welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, like you, is thrilled that school is out. Hooray! Homework headaches are behind us. It's time to throw the kids or grandkids in the car and take off. With that in mind, I offer up a great selection of family-friendly books, titles that are a joy to listen to, whether you've got a carload of kids or traveling solo. Rediscover the classics and introduce the young ones to some great reads. We're going on a road trip as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Robin Witten, editor of Audiophile magazine, returns to the Book Report for her monthly visit to fill us in on the family-friendly titles featured this month. Welcome, Robin. Thanks for checking back with us.
Hi, Elaine. I'm very glad to be here today.
Well, it seems like there's an amazing crop of titles for families, books that are just right for adults and kids. Tell us about some of your favorites.
Well, there really are. Family listening is one of my favorite topics, and if you can find audiobooks that suit everyone, it's interesting how the littlest kids can take something away from a story, and as you go up in age, right up to adults, everyone has their own little piece of the listening. So one of my favorite performers of children's audiobooks is possibly one of the most famous, and that is Jim Dale of Harry Potter fame. And I think this has been, he is known to many listeners and families who've gone through the Harry Potter books. And one of, there's another series that families can enjoy that is, the first one is Peter and the Star Catchers. Written by Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson.
Right.
But you have Jim Dale with all his fabulous voices.
I have to ask you, I listen to every Harry Potter book. Is Jim Dale British?
He is, and he holds a world record for the greatest number of, a Guinness World Record of the greatest number of character voices in one audiobook.
I didn't know there was such a thing. Wow.
And, you know, he can create such an array of fabulously memorable voices. And this Peter and the Star Catchers series is a great one to entertain all ages.
Right, and we're previewing that book today. And, of course, Dave Barry is a great friend of the Book Report and a great friend of mine. Did Dave and Ridley have any choices about choosing a narrator for this series?
I bet they did. And certainly to ask for Jim Dale was a coup, and I know that Jim had a great time recording the series. And, you know, when you have a lot of pirate voices and boys and action, it makes for a great audiobook.
I know that Dave Barry likes to walk around saying arg a lot, too. So,
well, while we're talking about pirates, I also wanted to mention that another great listening experience for families is the classic Treasure Island. And there is a wonderful version of, there's actually lots of versions of Treasure Island as audiobooks, but one of my favorites is read by Alfred Molina. And he is an actor that we see a lot in films. He does a few audiobooks, and they are special. So listening to Molina's Pirates is so fabulous, great fun. It is not Pirates of the Caribbean. We do not, you know, it is, it's sort of respects this wonderful classic by Robert Louis Stevenson, and yet we're completely drawn into the drama of Treasure Island.
I know. You know, when I was preparing the show, my producer said, Treasure Island. But, I mean, summer is really a great time to revisit a lot of classics that you read when you were so small, and you kind of get a whole new perspective to hear these wonderful treasures as an adult.
I think so. And, you know, we have just great listening. There's also a collection of Mark Twain stories that's on our list that has the notorious Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, one of his most famous stories. And especially for young listeners, this is always a hit.
Exactly, especially if they're going to have to read Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn next school year. So
that is right. And the narrator that we love for all of a lot of the Twain's novels and this collection of stories is Norman Dietz, who has a wonderful, approachable recording, and he never overplays these scenes, but again, he brings up Twain's wonderful language and the humor of the stories. You know, one of the things about family listening that I should also mention is a program that Audiophile is running for teens to help with some of the required summer reading, or for anyone who's involved in a summer reading program at their local library. We have two audiobooks each week starting in June that will be free, complete audiobooks. They're free downloads from Audiophile in a program called Sync, S-Y-N-C, and they each week we change to two new audiobooks. And actually, when we started the program, we gave away copies of The Hunger Games, which is also on your list today. This year we have a selection of 20 very exciting teen titles that are combinations of classics and some of that required reading and some of the favorites that the teens are listening to as well.
All right. Tell us once again the website where we can get all these great resources.
Okay. The audiophilemagazine.com is our main site, and the Sync teen listening program is audiobooksync.com.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Robin. And we really enjoy our monthly talks with you. Thanks for stopping by.
I love recommending such great listening. Thank you, Lorraine.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Best-selling authors Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson have turned back the clock and offer up their wild and wonderful prequel to J.M. Barrie's beloved Peter Pan. There are several Starcatcher books to choose from, and now there is the Neverland series. But I thought I'd catch you up with the first, Peter and the Starcatchers, Book 1, which is now, kudos to my friend Mr. Dave Barry, a hit on Broadway. In an evocative and fast-paced adventure on the high seas and on a faraway island, an orphan boy named Peter and his mysterious new friend Molly overcome bands of pirates and thieves in their quest to keep a fantastical secret safe and, of course, save the world from evil. The adventure takes you on a journey from a harsh English orphanage to a treacherous sea in a decrepit old tub. Aboard the Neverland is a trunk that holds a magical substance with the power to change the fate of the world. Just a sprinkle and wounds heal, and people can fly. Peter and the Starcatchers brims with richly developed characters, from the scary to the sweet, and of course, the one and only Peter. Narrator Jim Dale has an uncanny knack of knowing his characters, which adds immensely to the fun.
5 weeks, sir? Asked Peter.
If you're lucky, said Gremkin, leaning out of the carriage now to study the sky. If a storm doesn't blow you halfway to hell, he smiled again, or worse.
Worse than hell, sir?
Inquired James, the second youngest boy.
He means if the ship sinks, said Tubby Ted, who had a gift for looking on the dark side, and we wind up in the sea, swimming for our lives.
But I can't swim, said James. None of us can swim.
I can swim,
Tubby Ted declared proudly.
You can float, corrected Peter.
Even Gremkin cracked a smile at that, yellow tooth stumps showing through chapped lips. Peter looked down the wharf and saw a much nicer-looking and bigger ship painted a shiny black. Its crew wore uniforms, unlike that of the Neverland. It too was being loaded and seemed ready to set sail. If it came down to choosing between the two ships...
It don't matter, said Gremkin brightly, his mood improving. Swim, sink, or float. The sharks will take care of all you boys before you get a chance to drown.
Sharks, said James.
Big fish with lots of teeth, said Tubby Ted. They eat people.
What if there's no people in the sea,
said Thomas.
What do the sharks eat then?
Whales, said Tubby Ted.
But they like people better, and there's plenty of people in the sea. Ships is always going down. I heard about one.
Oh!
That's enough of your jabber,
said Gremkin, who had a rule against too much jabber. The carriage pulled to a stop beside the ship's aft gangplank. As Gremkin and the boys climbed out, a thick, bald man in a grimy officer's uniform thumped down the gangplank and approached the carriage.
You, Gremkin, he said.
I am, said Gremkin,
and you are?
Slank, William Slank, first officer, second in command of the Neverland.
The man made a face as if he'd just bitten into a rancid prune. It occurred to Peter that Slank didn't like being second in anything.
These are the orphans, then?
They are, said Gremkin,
and you're welcome to them.
I don't care for boys, observed Slank.
Then you'll definitely not care for these, said Gremkin.
We've had boys on board before, said Slank. They was always stirring up the rats.
The boys glanced at each other.
Rats?
The thing to do, said Gremkin, is keep them disciplined.
To illustrate, he shot his fist sideways, not looking where it was going. It struck Prentice, who, being fairly new, had not yet learned that it was unwise to stand immediately to Gremkin's right.
Oh, said Prentice.
Sir,
said James to Slank,
there's rats on the ship.
Don't you be playing with the rats, said Slank, cuffing James on the ear. They make a tasty treat when the food runs out.
The food runs out?
Asked Tubby Ted, suddenly reluctant to take another step.
When?
Slank slapped him across the ear and said,
after we eat you.
Gremkin nodded approvingly, confident now that he was leaving the boys in good hands. Peter scanned the area for a place to run and hide. He saw a supply store offering pulleys and hemp rope, some taverns, the salty dog, the mermaid's song.
Mermaids?
Peter wondered. But everywhere he looked, there were sailors and dock workers, rough men with rough hands. He wouldn't get 10 paces before one of them would collar him, if Slank didn't collar him first.
I'll be getting back to St. Norbert's,
Gremkin said. He turned toward the coach, paused for a moment, then turned back and said,
You boys better watch out for yourselves.
In 7 years, that was the nicest thing Peter had ever heard Gremkin say.
All right, said Slank, as Gremkin turned back to the coach. You boys get on board. We're waiting for one more piece of cargo, and then we cast off.
Peter eyed the nicer ship down the wharf. Some soldiers were approaching it, carrying rifles with bayonets. The soldiers wore crisp blue uniforms and black shiny boots. They walked on either side of a horse-drawn cart that carried a single trunk, black, done all around with chains and padlocks.
We've just heard Peter and the Starcatchers by Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson.
Lord.
The Book Report, your summer reading resource, presents another swashbuckler, Robert Louis Stevenson's cherished Treasure Island. The classic captures the thrill of a sea voyage and a treasure hunt through the eyes of young Jim Hawkins. Crossing the Atlantic in search of the buried cache, Jim and the ship's crew must brave the elements and a mutinous charge led by pirate Long John Silver. This is a novel that's captured the imagination of generations of adults and children alike. Narrator Alfred Molina performs a tale that seems new and entrancing. It's time to read it again.
And indeed, bad as his clothes were, and coarsely as he spoke, he had none of the appearance of a man who sailed before the mast, but seemed like a mate or skipper, accustomed to be obeyed or to strike. The man who came with the barrow told us the mail had set him down the morning before at the Royal George, that he had inquired what inns there were along the coast, and hearing ours well spoken of, I suppose, and described as lonely, had chosen it from the others for his place of residence. And that was all we could learn of our guest. He was a very silent man by custom. All day he hung round the cove, or upon the cliffs, with a brass telescope. All evening he sat in the corner of the parlour next to the fire and drank rum and water very strong. Mostly he would not speak when spoken to, only look up, sudden and fierce, and blow through his nose like a foghorn, and we and the people who came about our house soon learned to let him be. Every day when he came back from his stroll, he would ask if any seafaring men had gone by along the road. At first we thought it was the want of company of his own kind that made him ask this question, but at last we began to see he was desirous to avoid them. When a seaman put up at the Admiral Benbow, as now and then some did, making by the coast road for Bristol, he would look in at him through the curtained door before he entered the parlour, and he was always sure to be as silent as a mouse when any such was present. For me, at least, there was no secret about the matter, for I was, in a way, a sharer in his alarms. He had taken me aside one day, and promised me a silver fourpenny on the first of every month, if I would only keep my weather eye open for a seafaring man with one leg, and let him know the moment he appeared. Often enough, when the first of the month came round, and I applied to him for my wage, he would only blow through his nose at me and stare me down. But before the week was out, he was sure to think better of it, bring me my fourpenny piece, and repeat his orders to look out for the seafaring man with one leg. How that personage haunted my dreams, I need scarcely tell you. On stormy nights, when the wind shook the four corners of the house, and the surf roared along the cove and up the cliffs, I would see him in a thousand forms, and with a thousand diabolical expressions. Now the leg would be cut off at the knee, now at the hip. Now he was a monstrous kind of a creature who had never had but the one leg, and that in the middle of his body. To see him leap and run and pursue me over hedge and ditch was the worst of nightmares. And altogether I paid pretty dear for my monthly fourpenny piece, in the shape of these abominable fancies. But though I was so terrified by the idea of the seafaring man with one leg, I was far less afraid of the captain himself than anybody else who knew him. There were nights when he took a deal more rum and water than his head would carry, and then he would sometimes sit and sing his wicked old wild sea songs, minding nobody. But sometimes he would call for glasses round, and force all the trembling company to listen to his stories or bear a chorus to his singing. Often I've heard the house shaking with yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum, all the neighbours joining in for dear life, with the fear of death upon them, and each singing louder than the other to avoid remark. For in these fits, he was the most overriding companion ever known. He would slap his hand on the table for silence all round. He would fly up in a passion of anger at a question, or sometimes because none was put. And so he judged the company was not following his story. Nor would he allow anyone to leave the inn till he had drunk himself sleepy and reeled off to bed. His stories were what frightened people worst of all. Dreadful stories they were, about hanging and walking the plank and storms at sea and the dry tortugas and wild deeds and places on the Spanish main. By his own account, he must have lived his life among some of the wickedest men that God ever allowed upon the sea. And the language in which he told these stories shocked our plain country people almost as much as the crimes that he described. My father was always saying the inn would be ruined, for people would soon cease coming there to be tyrannized over and put down and sent shivering to their beds. But I really believe his presence did us good.
We've just heard Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
And while we're on the classics, perhaps you want to get the kids up to speed on what they'll be reading next fall. Or maybe, and more importantly, you'll want to experience this one again, brilliantly performed by Robertson Dean. The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald is the tale of a man who has everything, except for the one thing that will always be out of his reach. Day and night, his Long Island mansion buzzes with bright young things drinking, dancing, and debating their mysterious host. But Gatsby, young, handsome, and fabulously rich, always seems to be alone in the crowd, watching and waiting, though no one knows what for. Beneath the shimmering surface of his life, he's hiding a secret, a silent longing that can never be fulfilled.
The Carraways are something of a clan, and we have a tradition that we're descended from the Dukes of Buccleuch, but the actual founder of my line was my grandfather's brother, who came here in 51, sent a substitute to the Civil War, and started the wholesale hardware business that my father carries on today. I never saw this great-uncle, but I'm supposed to look like him, with special reference to the rather hard-boiled painting that hangs in father's office. I graduated from New Haven in 1915, just a quarter of a century after my father, and a little later, I participated in that delayed Teutonic migration known as the Great War. I enjoyed the counter-raid so thoroughly that I came back restless. Instead of being the warm center of the world, the Middle West now seemed like the ragged edge of the universe. So I decided to go east and learned the bond business. Everybody I knew was in the bond business, so I supposed it could support one more single man. All my aunts and uncles talked it over as if they were choosing a prep school for me, and finally said, "Why, yes," with very grave, hesitant faces. Father agreed to finance me for a year, and after various delays, I came east, permanently, I thought, in the spring of 22. The practical thing was to find rooms in the city, but it was a warm season, and I had just left a country of wide lawns and friendly trees, so when a young man at the office suggested that we take a house together in a commuting town, it sounded like a great idea. He found the house, a weather-beaten cardboard bungalow at 80 a month, but at the last minute the firm ordered him to Washington, and I went out to the country alone. I had a dog, at least I had him for a few days until he ran away, and an old Dodge and a Finnish woman who made my bed and cooked breakfast and muttered Finnish wisdom to herself over the electric stove. It was lonely for a day or so, until one morning some man, more recently arrived than I, stopped me on the road. "How do you get to West Egg Village?" he asked helplessly. I told him. As I walked on, I was lonely no longer. I was a guide, a pathfinder, an original settler. he had casually conferred on me the freedom of the neighborhood. And so, with the sunshine and the great bursts of leaves growing on the trees, just as things grow in fast movies, I had that familiar conviction that life was beginning over again with the summer. There was so much to read, for one thing, and so much fine health to be pulled down out of the young, breath-giving air. I bought a dozen volumes on banking and credit and investment securities, and they stood on my shelf in red and gold, like new money from the mint, promising to unfold the shining secrets that only Midas and Morgan and Maecenas knew. And I had the high intention of reading many other books besides. I was rather literary in college. One year I wrote a series of very solemn and obvious editorials for the Yale News, and now I was going to bring back all such things into my life and become again that most limited of all specialists, the well-rounded man. This isn't just an epigram. Life is much more successfully looked at from a single window, after all. It was a matter of chance that I should have rented a house in one of the strangest communities in North America. It was on that slender, riotous island which extends itself due east of New York, and where there are, among other natural curiosities, two unusual formations of land. 20 miles from the city, a pair of enormous eggs, identical in contour and separated only by a courtesy bay, jut out into the most domesticated body of salt water in the Western Hemisphere, the great wet barnyard of Long Island Sound. They are not perfect ovals. Like the egg in the Columbus story, they are both crushed flat at the contact end, but their physical resemblance must be a source of perpetual confusion to the gulls that fly overhead. To the wingless, a more arresting phenomenon is their dissimilarity in every particular except shape and size. I lived at West Egg, the less fashionable of the two, though this is a most superficial tag to express the bizarre and not a little sinister contrast between them. My house was at the very tip of the egg, only 50 yards from the sound, and squeezed between two huge places that rented for $12,000 or $15,000 a season.
That was The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Okay, the book report is moving on to popular culture, and here's one that's so current, you're probably off to see it at the multiplex, The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. To quote Stephen King, a fan of the book, The Hunger Games is a violent, jarring speed wrap of a novel that generates nearly constant suspense. I couldn't stop reading, unquote. In the ruins of a place once known as North America lies a shining capital surrounded by 12 outlying districts. The capital is harsh and cruel and keeps the districts in line by forcing them all to send one boy and one girl between the ages of 12 and 18 to participate in the annual Hunger Games, a fight to the death on live TV. 16-year-old Katniss Everdeen, who lives alone with her mother and younger sister, feels she's received a death sentence when she steps forward to take her sister's place in the games. But Katniss has been close to death before, and for her, survival is second nature. Without really meaning to, she becomes a contender. But if she's to win, she'll have to start making choices that weigh survival against humanity and life against love. Carolyn McCormick narrates.
When I wake up, the other side of the bed is cold. My fingers stretch out, seeking Prim's warmth, but finding only the rough canvas cover of the mattress. She must have had bad dreams and climbed in with our mother. Of course she did. This is the day of the reaping. I prop myself up on one elbow. There's enough light in the bedroom to see them. My little sister Prim, curled up on her side, cocooned in my mother's body, their cheeks pressed together. In sleep, my mother looks younger, still worn, but not so beaten down. Prim's face is as fresh as a raindrop, as lovely as the primrose for which she was named. My mother was very beautiful once, too, or so they tell me. Sitting at Prim's knees, guarding her, is the world's ugliest cat. Mashed-in nose, half of one ear missing, eyes the color of rotting squash. Prim named her Buttercup, insisting that his muddy yellow coat matched the bright flower. He hates me, or at least distrusts me. Even though it was years ago, I think he still remembers how I tried to drown him in a bucket when Prim brought him home. Scrawny kitten, belly swollen with worms, crawling with fleas. The last thing I needed was another mouth to feed. But Prim begged so hard, cried even, I had to let him stay. It turned out okay. My mother got rid of the vermin, and he's a born mouser. Even catches the occasional rat. Sometimes, when I clean a kill, I feed Buttercup the entrails. He stopped hissing at me. Entrails. No hissing. This is the closest we will ever come to love. I swing my legs off the bed and slide into my hunting boots. Supple leather that is molded to my feet. I pull on trousers, a shirt, tuck my long dark braid up into a cap, and grab my forage bag. On the table, under a wooden bowl, to protect it from hungry rats and cats alike, sits a perfect little goat cheese wrapped in basil leaves. Prim's gift to me on reaping day. I put the cheese carefully in my pocket as I slip outside. Our part of District 12, nicknamed the Seam, is usually crawling with coal miners heading out to the morning shift at this hour. Men and women with hunched shoulders, swollen knuckles, many who have long since stopped trying to scrub the coal dust out of their broken nails, the lines of their sunken faces. But today the black cinder streets are empty. Shutters on the squat gray houses are closed. The reaping isn't until 2. May as well sleep in, if you can. Our house is almost at the edge of the Seam. I only have to pass a few gates to reach the scruffy field called the Meadow. Separating the meadow from the woods, in fact, enclosing all of District 12, is a high chain-link fence topped with barbed wire loops. In theory, it's supposed to be electrified 24 hours a day as a deterrent to the predators that live in the woods, packs of wild dogs, lone cougars, bears that used to threaten our streets. But since we're lucky to get 2 or 3 hours of electricity in the evenings, it's usually safe to touch. Even so, I always take a moment to listen carefully for the hum that means the fence is live. Right now, it's silent as a stone. Concealed by a clump of bushes, I flatten out on my belly and slide under a 2-foot stretch that's been loose for years. There are several other weak spots in the fence, but this one is so close to home, I almost always enter the woods here. As soon as I'm in the trees, I retrieve a bow and sheath of arrows from a hollow log. Electrified or not, the fence has been successful at keeping the flesh-eaters out of District 12. Inside the woods, they roam freely, and there are added concerns like venomous snakes, rabid animals, and no real paths to follow. But there's also food if you know how to find it.
That was The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. Nobody Owens, known to his friends as Bod, is a normal boy. Kinda. He would be completely normal if he didn't live in a sprawling graveyard, being raised and educated by ghosts with a solitary guardian who neither belongs to the world of the living nor of the dead. In Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard book, dangers and adventures are never far away. And if Bod leaves the graveyard, he'll come under attack from the man who has already killed Bod's family. Master storyteller Neil Gaiman, who performs the work, returns with a luminous novel that's magical, terrifying, and filled with breathtaking adventures to enthrall all ages.
The man Jack's eyes were accustomed to the dim moonlight, so he had no desire to turn on an electric light. And light was not that important, after all. He had other skills. The man Jack sniffed the air. He ignored the sense that had come into the room with him, dismissed the sense that he could safely ignore, honed in on the smell of the thing he had come to find. He could smell the child, a milky smell, like chocolate chip cookies, and the sour tang of a wet, disposable nighttime diaper. He could smell the baby shampoo in its hair, and something small and rubbery. A toy, he thought, then no, something to suck, that the child had been carrying. The child had been here. It was here no longer. The man Jack followed his nose down the stairs, through the middle of the tall, thin house. He inspected the bathroom, the kitchen, the airing cupboard, and finally the downstairs hall, in which there was nothing to be seen but the family's bicycles, a pile of empty shopping bags, a fallen diaper, and the stray tendrils of fog that had insinuated themselves into the hall from the open door to the street. The man Jack made a small noise then, a grunt that contained in it both frustration and also satisfaction. He slipped the knife into its sheath in the inside pocket of his long coat, and he stepped out into the street. There was moonlight, and there were streetlights, but the fog stifled everything, muted light and muffled sound, and made the night shadowy and treacherous. He looked down the hill towards the light of the closed shops, then up the street, where the last high houses wound up the hill on their way to the darkness of the old graveyard. The man Jack sniffed the air. Then, without hurrying, he began to walk up the hill. Ever since the child had learned to walk, he had been his mother's and father's despair and delight, for there never was such a boy for wandering, for climbing up things, for getting into and out of things. That night, he'd been woken by the sound of something on the floor beneath him falling with a crash. Awake, he soon became bored, and had begun looking for a way out of his crib. It had high sides, like the walls of his playpen downstairs, but he was convinced that he could scale it. All he needed was a step. He pulled his large golden teddy bear into the corner of the crib, then, holding the railing in his tiny hands, he put his foot onto the bear's lap, the other foot up on the bear's head, and he pulled himself up into a standing position, and then he half-climbed, half-toppled over the railing and out of the crib. He landed with a muffled thump on a small mound of furry, fuzzy toys, some of them presents from relations from his first birthday, not 6 months gone, some of them inherited from his older sister. He was surprised when he hit the floor, but he did not cry out. If you cried, they came and put you back in your crib. He crawled out of the room. Stairs that went up were tricky things, and he had not yet entirely mastered them. Stairs that went down, however, he had discovered were fairly simple. He did them sitting down, bumping from step to step on his well-padded bottom. He sucked on his nummer, the rubber pacifier his mother had just begun to tell him that he was getting too old for. His diaper had worked itself loose on his journey, on his bottom, down the stairs. And when he reached the last step, when he reached the little hall and stood up, the diaper fell off. He stepped out of it. He was only wearing a child's nightshirt. The stairs that led back up to his room and his family were steep, but the door to the street was open and inviting. The child stepped out of the house a little hesitantly. The fog wreathed around him like a long-lost friend. And then, uncertainly at first, then with increasing speed and confidence, the boy tottered up the hill. The fog was thinner as you approached the top of the hill. The half moon shone, not as bright as day, not by any means, but enough to see the graveyard. Enough for that.
That was The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman. Ender's Game is a science fiction classic by Orson Scott Card that not only transcends its genre, but also redefines it. This special 20th anniversary edition features a multi-voiced, highly dramatized reading. The war with the buggers has been raging for 100 years. The quest for the perfect general has been underway for almost as long. Enter Andrew Ender Wiggin, the result of decades of genetic experimentation. Is Ender the general Earth so desperately needs? The only way to find out is to throw him into ever harsher training at battle school to chip away and find the diamond inside, or destroy him utterly. Ender Wiggin is 6 years old when his training begins. He will grow up fast, but Ender is not the only result of the experiment. His two older siblings, Peter and Valentine, are every bit as unusual as he is, but in very different ways. Among the three of them lie the abilities to remake a world if the world can survive. The story of Ender Wiggin's works as great science fiction, full of thought-provoking ideas and interesting details. But it works even better as a human story, as Wiggin struggles with many of the personal issues we all face.
I'm practicing piano, Ender. Come turn the pages for me. Oh, is the monitor boy too busy to help his brother? Is he too smart? Gotta go kill some buggers, astronaut? No, no, I don't want your help. I can do it on my own, you little third. This won't take long, Andrew, said the doctor. Ender nodded. It's designed to be removed without infection, without damage, but there'll be some tickling, and some people say they have a feeling of something missing. You'll keep looking around for something you were looking for, but you can't find it and you can't remember what it was. So I'll tell you, it's the monitor you're looking for, and it isn't there. In a few days, that feeling will pass. The doctor was twisting something at the back of Ender's head. Suddenly, a pain stabbed through him like a needle, from his neck to his groin. Ender felt his back spasm, and his body arched violently backward. His head struck the bed. He could feel his legs thrashing, and his hands were clenching each other, wringing each other so tightly that they arched. "Dee Dee," shouted the doctor, "I need you." The nurse ran in, gasped. Got to relax these muscles. Get it to me, now. What are you waiting for? Something changed hands. Ender could not see. He lurched to one side and fell off the examining table. Catch him, cried the nurse. Just hold him steady. You hold him, doctor. He's too strong for me. Not the whole thing. You'll stop his heart. Ender felt a needle enter his back just above the neck of his shirt. It burned. But wherever in him the fire spread, his muscles gradually unclenched. Now he could cry for the fear and pain of it.
Are you all right, Andrew?
The nurse asked. Andrew could not remember how to speak. They lifted him onto the table. They checked his pulse, did other things. He did not understand it all. The doctor was trembling. His voice shook as he spoke. They leave these things in the kids for 3 years. What do they expect? We could have switched him off. Do you realize that? We could have unplugged his brain for all time.
When does the drug wear off? Asked the nurse.
Keep him here for at least an hour. Watch him. If he doesn't start talking in 15 minutes, call me. Could have unplugged him forever. I don't have the brains of a bugger. He got back to Miss Pumphrey's class only 15 minutes before the closing bell. He was still a little unsteady on his feet.
"Are you all right, Andrew?"
asked Miss Pumphrey. He nodded.
"Were you ill?"
He shook his head.
"You don't look well.
I'm okay.
You'd better sit down, Andrew."
He started toward his seat, but stopped. Now what was I looking for? I can't think what I was looking for.
"Your seat is over there," said Miss Pumphrey.
He sat down, but it was something else he needed, something he had lost. I'll find it later.
Your monitor,
whispered the girl behind him. Andrew shrugged.
His monitor,
she whispered to the others. Andrew reached up and felt his neck. There was a Band-Aid. It was gone. He was just like everybody else now.
Washed out, Andy?
Asked a boy who sat across the aisle and behind him. Couldn't think of his name. Peter? No, that was someone else.
Quiet, Mr. Stilson, said Miss Pumphrey.
Stilson smirked.
Miss Pumphrey talked about multiplication.
Ender doodled on his desk, drawing contour maps of mountainous islands and then telling his desk to display them in three dimensions from every angle. The teacher would know, of course, that he wasn't paying attention, but she wouldn't bother him. He always knew the answer, even when she thought he wasn't paying attention. In the corner of his desk, a word appeared and began marching around the perimeter of the desk. It was upside down and backward at first, but Ender knew what it said long before it reached the bottom of the desk and turned right side up. Third. Ender smiled. He was the one who had figured out how to send messages and make them march. Even as his secret enemy called him names, the method of delivery praised him. It was not his fault he was a third. It was the government's idea. They were the ones who authorized it. How else could a third like Ender have got into school? Now the monitor was gone. The experiment entitled Andrew Wiggin hadn't worked out after all. If they could, he was sure they would like to rescind the waivers that had allowed him to be born at all. Didn't work, so erase the experiment.
That was Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
A mysterious island, an abandoned orphanage, a strange collection of very curious photographs. It all waits to be discovered in Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, an unforgettable, eccentric novel by Ransom Riggs, which Amazon selected as Best Book of the Month last June. As the story opens, a horrific family tragedy sets 16-year-old Jacob journeying to the remote island off the coast of Wales, where he discovers the crumbling ruins of Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. As Jacob explores its abandoned bedrooms and hallways, it becomes clear the children were more than just peculiar. They may have been dangerous. They may have been quarantined on a deserted island for good reason, and somehow, impossible though it seems, they may still be alive. A spine-tingling fantasy, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children will delight readers who relish an adventure in the shadows. Jesse Bernstein narrates.
It wasn't long before I had trouble falling asleep. My hyperactive imagination transforming the hiss of tires on wet pavement into labored breathing just outside my window, or shadows under the door into twisting gray-black tentacles. I was scared of the monsters, but thrilled to imagine my grandfather battling them and surviving to tell the tale. More fantastic still were his stories about life in the Welsh children's home. "It was an enchanted place," he said, "designed to keep kids safe from the monsters on an island where the sun shined every day and nobody ever got sick or died. Everyone lived together in a big house that was protected by a wise old bird, or so the story went. As I got older, though, I began to have doubts. What kind of bird?" I asked him one afternoon at age 7. Eyeing him skeptically across the card table where he was letting me win at Monopoly. "A big hawk who smoked a pipe," he said. "You must think I'm pretty dumb, Grandpa." He thumbed through his dwindling stack of orange and blue money. "I would never think that about you, Jacob." I knew I'd offended him because the Polish accent he could never quite shake had come out of hiding, so that would became would, and think became sink. Feeling guilty, I decided to give him the benefit of the doubt. But why did the monsters want to hurt you? I asked.
Because we weren't like other people. We were peculiar.
Peculiar how?
Oh, all sorts of ways, he said. There was a girl who could fly, a boy who had bees living inside him, a brother and sister who could lift boulders over their heads.
It was hard to tell if he was being serious. Then again, my grandfather was not known as a teller of jokes. He frowned, reading the doubt on my face.
Fine, you don't have to take my word for it, he said. I got pictures.
He pushed back his lawn chair and went into the house, leaving me alone on the screened-in lanai. A minute later, he came back holding an old cigar box. I leaned in to look as he drew out four wrinkled and yellowing snapshots. The first was a blurry picture of what looked like a suit of clothes with no person in them. Either that or the person didn't have a head.
Sure, he's got the head, my grandfather said, grinning. Only you can't see it.
Why not? Is he invisible?
Hey, look at the brain on this one.
He raised his eyebrows as if I'd surprised him with my powers of deduction.
Millard, his name was. Funny kid. Sometimes he'd say, Hey, Abe, I know what you did today. And he'd tell you where you'd been, what you had to eat, if you picked your nose when you thought nobody was looking. Sometimes he'd follow you, quiet as a mouse, with no clothes on so you couldn't see him, just watching.
He shook his head.
Of all the things, eh?
He slipped me another photo. Once I'd had a moment to look at it, he said,
So, what do you see?
A little girl?
And?
She's wearing a crown. He tapped the bottom of the picture.
What about her feet?
I held the snapshot closer. The girl's feet weren't touching the ground, but she wasn't jumping. She seemed to be floating in the air. My jaw fell open. She's flying.
Close, my grandfather said. She's levitating. Only she couldn't control herself too well, so sometimes we had to tie a rope around her to keep her from floating away.
My eyes were glued to her haunting doll-like face. Is it real?
Of course it is, he said gruffly,
taking the picture and replacing it with another, this one of a scrawny boy lifting a boulder.
We've just heard Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children by Ransom Riggs. Mark Twain, one of the greatest writers of fiction, was a master at writing short stories. Twain influenced almost every subsequent American writer, from Hemingway to Fitzgerald, Cather to Robert Frost. Now, hear four of his best short stories, starting with his most famous, The Notorious Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, plus three other favorites, A True Story, Niagara, and The White Elephant. For students, this is a wonderful lead-in to Twain's great novels they might be assigned next school season. And for adults, it doesn't get much better. Bill DeWeese captures just the right voice for these great American stories.
Parson Walker's wife laid very sick once for a good while, and it seemed as if they weren't going to save her. But one morning he came in, and Smiley asked him how she was, and he said she was considerable better, thanked the Lord for his infinite mercy, and coming on so smart that, with the blessing of Providence, she'd get well yet. And Smiley, before he thought, says, Well, I'll risk 2.5 that she don't, anyway. This year Smiley had a mare. The boys called her the 15-minute nag, but that was only in fun, you know, because, of course, she was faster than that, and he used to win money on that horse. For all she was so slow and always had the asthma, or the distemper, or the consumption, or something of that kind. They used to give her 200 or 300 yard start, and then pass her underway. but always at the fag end of the race, she'd get excited and desperate-like and come cavorting and straddling up and scattering her legs around limber, sometimes in the air, and sometimes out to one side amongst the fences, and kicking up more dust and raising more racket with her coughing and sneezing and blowing her nose and always fetch up at the stand just about a neck ahead, as near you could cipher it down. And he had a little small bullpup, that to look at him you'd think he wa'n't worth a cent, but to set around and look ornery and lay for a chance to steal something. But as soon as money was up on him, he was a different dog. His underjaw'd begin to stick out like the fo'castle of a steamboat, and his teeth would uncover and shine savage like the furnaces. And a dog might tackle him and bullyrag him and bite him and throw him over his shoulder two or three times, and Andrew Jackson, which was the name of the pup, Andrew Jackson would never let on, but he was satisfied and hadn't expected nothing else, and the bets being doubled and doubled on the other side all the time, till the money was all up. And then, all of a sudden, he would grab that other dog just by the gin of his hind leg and freeze to it. Not chaw, you understand, but only just grip and hang on till they throwed up the sponge, if it was a year. Smiley always came out winner on that pup, till he harnessed a dog once that didn't have no hind legs, because it'd been sawed off by a circular saw. And when the thing had gone along far enough, and the money was all up, and he came to make a snatch for his pet Holt, he said in a minute how he'd be imposed on, and how the other dog had him in the door, so to speak, and he peered surprised. And then he looked sorter discouraged-like and didn't try no more to win the fight. And so he got shucked out bad. He gave Smiley a look, as much as to say his heart was broke, and it was his fault for putting up a dog that hadn't no hind legs, and for him to take hold of, which was his main dependence in a fight. And then he limped off a piece and laid down and died. It was a good pup, was that Andrew Jackson, and would have made a name for himself if he'd lived. For the stuff was in him, and he had genius. I know it, because he hadn't no opportunities to speak of, and it don't stand to reason that a dog could make such a fight as he could under circumstances, if he had no talent. It always makes me feel sorry when I think of that last fight of his'n, and the way it turned out. Well, this year Smiley had rat terriers, and chicken cocks, and tomcats, and all them kind of things, till you couldn't rest, and you couldn't fetch nothing for him to bet on, but he'd match you. He catched a frog one day, and took him home, and said he calculated to eradicate him. And so he never done nothing for 3 months, but sat in his backyard and learned that frog to jump. And you bet you he did learn him, too. He'd give him a little punch behind, and the next minute you'd see that frog whirling in the air like a donut. See him turn one somerset, or maybe a couple, and if he got a good start, and come down flat-footed and all right, like a cat. He got him up so in the matter of catching flies, and kept him in practice so constant that he'd nail a fly every time as far as he could see him. Smiley said all a frog wanted was education, and he could do most anything. And I believe him. Why, I've seen him set Dan'l Webster down here on this floor. Dan'l Webster was the name of the frog, and sing out, "Flies, Dan'l flies!" And quicker'n you could wink, he'd spring straight up and snake a fly off on the counter there, and flop down on the floor again as solid as a gob of mud, and fall to scratching the side of his head with a signed foot as indifferent as if he'd had no idea he'd been doing any more than any frog might do. You never see a frog so modest and straightforward as he was, for all he was so gifted. And when it came to fair and square jumping on a dead level, he could get over more ground at one straddle than any animal of his breed you ever see. Jumping on a dead level was his strong suit, you understand. And when it come to that, Smiley would ante up money on him as long as he had a red. Smiley was monstrous proud of his frog, and well he might be, for fellers that had traveled and been everywheres all said he laid over any frog that they ever see. Well, Smiley kept the beast in a little lattice box, and he used to fetch him downtown sometimes and lay for a bet.
That was 4 Mark Twain stories by Mark Twain. Readers, thanks so much for joining me today. I hope you've enjoyed these titles and agree they are a great way to get the family revved on great literature. You'll find a wide range of titles for every interest on my website, bookreportradio.com. Take a look, then take a listen. See you back here next week on The Book Report.